for the week of September 25th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 337, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Hofstra University, I'm Michael Giltz.
Finally, Michael, you've decided to go back to school. I mean, I've been saying...
Well, I'm trying to get that degree.
Yes. You know, I figure it's a midlife crisis type of thing.
I'm here for the debates, which will be over by the time people hear our show, analyzed to death, so we don't have to talk about it.
No, I think the cat won.
Well, let's hope it's not Lester Holt, because he's not running for president. So my only message to the media was, focus more on the candidates. The guy doing the moderation isn't that important. Whatever job he does, it's okay. 1% of your time you can spend on him. 99%, how about focusing on the people actually running for president?
I think you're talking about what happened when Matt Lauer hosted one of these things.
I'm talking about all media coverage.
Oh, okay. And I don't know why I picked a cat. Cat, dog, I don't know. It's just, this has gotten out of control.
As long as you didn't pick an elephant or a donkey, because that would have tipped your hat.
That's true.
Anyway, what are we going to talk about on this show, which is not going to be about the debates?
On this week's show, we're going to take a deep dive into music and look at the increasing amount of money being made by streaming services. That's right, Michael. The music industry is making money again. I mean, all the streaming revenue hasn't made up for the fall off in actual sales, but perhaps it will in the future. Now, some of you may recall last week I attended the Geneva Convention. This week we'll discuss NATO and specifically the kerfuffle between them and Fox and AMC Theaters. We'll also take a look at a tale of two franchises, DC and Marvel. For one, it is the best of times. For the other, it could be worse. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to head to New Jersey to name the number one book of the week. I think it's Boss. That's a little hint for some of you. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at the turmoil at Viacom and especially Paramount. Can their upcoming movies turn it around? I don't think so. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We also look at Box Office Mojo and Profits, The Numbers, LA Times, New York Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, and the number one movie around the world is a Western. It is The Magnificent Seven, a remake of a remake, $54 million around the world, $59 million total and counting. At number two around the world is an animated film, Storks. $40 million on its opening weekend for this film from Warner Brothers, a studio that hasn't really been focusing on animation, but is doing more of that now. And number three is Bridget Jones's Baby, $26 million over the weekend. It's not doing well in North America, but it's doing much better overseas, $83 million worldwide.
That's a hard title to say, I've noticed.
Bridget Jones's Baby.
Yeah.
And the book is called Bridget Jones's Baby Diary. Ugh. As if the baby is keeping a diary. At number four is what Ann Thompson of Thompson's on Hollywood thought would be an Oscar contender, or will be an Oscar contender. I'm not so sure. It's Sully, $20 million over the weekend, $126 million worldwide. It's Clint Eastwood and Tom Hanks. It's not a bad bet, but I just feel like people aren't going to remember this once Oscar season rolls around.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a Captain Phillips problem, right? I mean, Tom Hanks movie.
Well, that felt more weightier. That felt weightier to me. This one is just nice. You know, that one felt like it was about something. This just feels nice.
I am the captain.
And number five is The Secret Life of Pets, another modestly budgeted animated film. I hope Pixar's employees aren't going, I hope they don't notice we can make animated films for less than $200 million. You know what? The quality of them and the animation is much better. So, you know.
Well, the technology is getting to the point where you don't need, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of servers to...
to make a good movie.
Yeah, to render the animation.
But the animation, and you know, I mean, is the animation better? Is the quality better? Is it a better big budget movie from Pixar than you're getting from something like Storks and Secret Life of Pets? I'm not speaking quality. I'm just speaking the product itself.
Well, I think you're talking, your animation quality, right? And story.
So, and artistry, yeah.
And so I would still say Pixar's far outpaces everybody else. They kind of set the bar.
But do they have to cost almost three times as much?
There's the rub. I don't know. Maybe the infrastructure in place costs that much. I don't know.
Well, Secret Life of Pets made $8 million over the weekend. It's $820 million worldwide. And number six is Don't Breathe, a horror flick, $8 million. That's just about what it costs to make. But it's at $120 million worldwide. Less successful is Blair Witch, the latest sequel and or prequel to that franchise. $7 million over the weekend, $25 million worldwide. Didn't cost much to make, but they certainly marketed it, but not a lot. So they're probably going to be just fine.
Yeah, I mean, look, what, it costs like $5 million to make. So please, you know, what were you expecting from this?
At number eight is Suicide Squad, $6 million over the weekend, $730 million worldwide for a movie nobody liked, but it keeps chugging along at the box office, doesn't it? Somebody's going.
Yeah, well, and I can't wait for the stars and director, and like all the people who are profit participants in this movie to start saying, hey, where's mine? And they're going to say, oh, it was such a disaster, remember? It's like, well, no, it made $730 million. It's on a chugging its way to $800 million. Yes, it cost $200 million to make, $200 million to market. That leaves a chunk of change.
It's awfully expensive making and releasing movies.
That's true.
I guess with animated films, Warner Brothers can rest easily, right? You know, the cartoons don't speak up.
That's right. You know, you never see Porky Pig going, I want more.
Yeah, Toontown is a non-union town, I guess.
Yes.
At number nine is A Chinese Odyssey Part 3, The End, a soft weekend in China. I think it was still number one at the box office with $6 million, but not a great weekend for Chinese box office. $48 million worldwide and counting for that movie. And number 10 is Snowden. Oliver Stone's would-be Oscar hopeful. Joseph Gordon-Levitt's would-be breakthrough film as an actor. You know, I want him to be a big commercial star. He's made lovely films before, success on TV. I want him to be even bigger. It's not going to do it for either of them. $5.8 million over the weekend and just $17 million in counting. At number 11 is Bad Moms, also doing great, $165 million worldwide. Then at number 12 is Finding Dory. We don't really know what the budget is. We're guessing $175 to $200 million because it's Pixar and it's a sequel to a hugely successful movie. So all the voice actors, I'm sure, got a payday. That made $5 million over the weekend, $970 million. It needs $30 million more to get to $1 billion, but I don't think there's any territories left. Is there any big territory left, and is there any way to find out? Other than calling up the studio, is there any site, anything? If you know of how we could figure out what territories are left for a movie, what should people do?
Well, they could write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or they could call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Some people reach out to us via Twitter, where our handle is ShowbizSandbox, just @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for ShowbizSandbox, our official ShowbizSandbox page can be found and liked.
I think it was Variety that cleared up the movie title of this next film. It's called S-Storm. Or, if you prefer, a.k.a. Z-Storm 2. So it's Z-Storm 2, but now Z-Storm has turned into S-Storm. But yes, this is the same movie. It's a Chinese Hong Kong action thriller, and it made $5 million over the weekend. It's at $28 million worldwide. Following it is another Chinese film. This is a romantic drama. It's called Soulmate. Another $5 million for that movie, and that's at $20 million worldwide.
And these then are films that are only playing in China.
Well, S-Storm is playing in six territories. So you've got China, Hong Kong, and I don't know what the other ones
maybe
are.
Maybe Korea, Japan. I mean, just, but still, for them to be making this much money in those territories, it's pretty remarkable.
Well, those are both pretty low-grossing movies, I would say. They're not they're not actually tearing it up. $20 million and $28 million is not exactly setting the house on fire.
No.
I think doing a little better is Korea's Oscar hopeful. It's called The Age of Shadows. It's a period flick. It costs $9 million to make, we think, and it's already at $51 million worldwide, and that is just playing in Korea, though obviously they have high hopes for it. If it gets an Oscar nomination, is doing well in its own territory, it might just spread out to other parts of the world.
I just got an invitation to a screening of this. Unfortunately, I don't know if I can go, but it's going to open in the United States.
Oh, of course it is. And you never know when a movie is going to open up in a new territory. I mean, we just never know. Going down to number 21 on this chart, we find Chibi Maruko-chan. It's a boy from Italy. It's a Japanese animated film based on the popular manga Chibi Maruko. And this is a hugely popular manga geared towards girls. That's sort of the focus audience. It's written by a young woman who was like in high school when she started writing it. It's sold 30 million copies in Japan and around the world. So it's very popular. It's not the hugest manga of all time, but it's a very, very, very hugely popular one. It's been a TV show and then another TV TV show. This Japanese animated movie came out in Japan like a year ago, and now, out of nowhere, it's opening up in China. $2.7 million over the weekend, so they made a little money. I don't know what it cost to market it. They probably had the digital print. So, you know, when we think a movie is done, you know, 6 months, 8 months down the road, it could pop up in a new country. So we always have to pay attention to the worldwide box office.
In fact, No Manches Frida, not to put you on the spot, but do you know where this film is from?
Where it's from? Well, it's Mexican, and it's the remake of the German comedy. Darn you, Goethe.
Oh, okay. Okay, yes.
And this is playing in North America and, I guess, Mexico. It's in two territories. $16 million and counting for that movie.
Yeah, I see that it's playing here by me in a couple of places.
Yeah, one movie that's not playing at a theater near you is I Am Not Madame Bovary. What's happening with that movie in China?
I think it was delayed, right? I guess it was supposed to be released September 30th, and now somehow it's scheduled for November. But I don't know. There's some, you know.
It's fishy. It's fishy. Yeah. This is a movie that takes petty bureaucracy to task. And that wouldn't be the first Chinese film to do that. Zhang Yimou has made movies like that, even though he's now painted as some sort of, you know, pawn of the government. He has often created films that take the government to task, at least in years past. This movie, I don't think, is scathing towards the government. It's just more towards mid-level and lower-level people, but I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure. But it passed the censors, at least that's what the people who made the movie said, so that's not the issue. But again, in China, there's always this internal battle as far as when a movie gets made and where it gets made, and somebody who doesn't like it or feels like it ruffles too many feathers might put the kibosh on it. So there is a question mark about this movie, and we're going to wait to see what happens. You know, if the government didn't like Snowden, and I know Obama was no fan of Snowden, the movie, they don't just stop it from being released. So when something happens like that in another country, it's sort of interesting about their culture and their politics and how these games work. And we'll keep our eye on I Am Not Madame Bovary and wait to see if it comes out.
Well, we're going to talk about something in a moment here that, you'll see.
We can do it right now about Sony and Wanda.
Yeah, because you know what? I'm looking at this and I'm looking at, and I guess maybe we should say what happened here. Sony Pictures Entertainment, and I've always said, you know, everybody's wondering when Wanda or a Chinese company will come in and purchase a U.S. Hollywood movie studio.
When they get the chance.
Yeah, pretty much. And I said, look, the only two studios right now that would be viable for an acquisition are Paramount and Sony. So what you have here is Sony Pictures Entertainment teaming up teaming up is the right word, with Dalian Wanda Group. Of course, if that name sounds familiar, we've talked about them before. They are the largest exhibitor in China with 2,000 screens, and they own AMC Theaters, and they're trying to purchase Carmike here in the U.S., and they're in the process of purchasing Odeon UCI in Europe, and they purchased Hoyts in Australia. So they are the world's largest exhibitor. Granted, they have, you know, different brands and different companies throughout the world doing it. But here's the rub, and this happened, by the way, in the United States in the 30s and 40s, and that is the studios owned the movie theaters and then forced those movie theaters to play the movies they made.
Well, forced, it's their own theaters. They were happy to.
Right. Well, it turns out the same thing is really happening in in China, because if you look at Wanda, has a very big investment in a little company named Legendary Entertainment. They spent $3 billion to acquire the company. That company made a little movie called, what is the name of the movie?
Warcraft,
thank you. I wanted to say War Games, and I knew that was wrong. So they made Warcraft. Didn't do so well over here. But when you look at it, Warcraft did great in China. Well, Wanda forced all of their, well, not forced, but booked all of their theaters with Warcraft. 80% of its scheduling slots went to Warcraft on opening day, and 70% later that weekend and later during the week. So, in other words,
they made that movie a big hit in China.
Correct.
And are you upset about vertical integration in China? Do you think China should not have that? Do you think it's an evil?
I think that you have to be careful, is what I'm saying. You have to be very, I mean, you basically can pick your winners at that point.
Well, people aren't going to go see a movie just because it's on 3,000 screens.
Well, correct. Although if it's
it worked for a while, I guess, in the U.S., but eventually it stopped working.
Right. Well, and there was a Supreme Court ruling that forbade.
No. I don't mean vertical integration. I mean, you used to be able to open up big movies and people would just show up on opening weekend because it seemed like that was the big movie of the week. That doesn't work anymore in North America. We've seen that, you know, it just doesn't play. Just because you open a big movie, you're not going to get some box office on opening weekend. maybe that works a little more still in China than it did 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, and I guess I look at this and I think, you know what, in China, we all know, you know, the deck is rigged, so to speak, for certain companies. It just is. You know, whether they're Chinese, there could be one Chinese company that has the deck stacked in their favor over another Chinese company. But in a market where things really are never even and it's really not open, I guess I look at this type of activity, this type of vertical integration, as you call it, Michael, which is exactly what it is, and go, you know what? You're picking your winners even before you make your movies.
Right, but that's not what this story is about. It's not about Wanda's vertical integration in China. You're talking about Sony making a marketing deal with Wanda. Why? Because they don't have easy access to the Chinese market, and teaming up with Wanda, they believe, will give them a heads up and give them an advantage on other American companies, right?
Right. And what does it get Wanda? Well, it gets Wanda some knowledge about Hollywood filmmaking.
That's right. And do you think Sony gave away the farm to get this deal, or does it seem like a reasonable deal? Did they give away too much?
Well, you know, I don't think so. You know, one of the things that Sony gave up or could give up is that Wanda could invest in some of the and be a profit participant in some of the films should Sony agree. So there's that whole thing.
Right. Well, that's sort of a case by case basis. But it's scary. You make big budget $200 million movies. You want access to what is going to be the number one movie market in just a few years. And that's, of course, got to be on the minds of Disney and Warner Brothers. They've got these, you know, Marvel and DC movies, and they want access to China, don't they? It's very difficult having all these franchises. And by franchises, we mean strings of movies coming out every year in these super universes.
Yeah, and I know you want to kind of talk about DC and Marvel here. I guess what I would say is when you're doing business, you don't really have a free market if you're forcing people who are coming into it, companies coming into it, to do business with people and companies in your country.
They don't pretend to have a free market. They
yeah,
don't
that's true.
Even think they want a free market. So yeah, they know that.
Okay. Well, okay. So you're talking now, and you tried to move us along into this whole thing where the Time Warner chief, Jeff Bukes, kind of looked at DC movies and kind of shook his head and went, you know what? I think we can do better. I think we could probably make better movies.
Yeah, this is a tale of two franchises. Jeff Bukes, talking about the DC movie, says, quote, there's room for improvement, end quote. Okay. And then Disney, Robert Iger, talking about Rogue One, which is coming out at Christmas, is trying to tamp down expectations. He says, hey, look, this is an experiment, this movie. We don't expect it to do Star Wars business, which is fair enough because Star Wars made $2 billion worldwide. So we don't know the budget for Rogue One. That's not clear. I got to imagine it's at least $125 million, right?
At least.
Well,
yes.
There's no big names in it, but yeah, 150. I mean, who knows? I mean,
but what it is, what's really driving up these budgets is not only the stars. Okay, of course, that helps to drive up the budget.
Well, aren't these post-star movies, a lot of them? You know, aren't we in a post-star world?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you still pay for certain talent, but really what you're paying for is the speed at which you're making these movies. When you need to make a movie in a year and a half that usually takes 3 years to make, well, you're paying for a lot of labor.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Every movie is budgeted because it's being made so much quicker than it used to be?
No.
All these $200 million movies are costing $200 million because you're making them so quickly? What's costing them a lot. I thought it was just, you know, special effects, the elaborate nature of them, the gigantic size of them, and so on. If they took 3 years to make it, it would only cost like $100 million or $150.
I would be interested to know what the price differential would be from making your movie in 18 months versus making your movie in 3 years. I think you'd probably see a good 10 to 20% bounce.
Well, if you make a movie in 3 years, you're talking about a long time of script writing and pre-production. You're not talking about filming.
Well, no, of course. You film, what, maybe 6 months tops?
So it's the end section where you're rushing the special effects and
correct,
you're out to every house. That's where you see the big price tag coming.
Right. And beforehand, when you're doing prep work and you're, you know, building the sets and you're, you know, doing all of that groundwork before you shoot, that all that needs to be done in a compressed period of time when you're shooting that quickly and you're moving that quickly
toward
a release.
I don't understand quickly. They map these movies out 3-5 years in advance. We know what Star Wars movie is coming out 3 years from now. Why do you say they're not spending 3 years to make it?
Well, I think
we know what's coming out in 2020. I beg your pardon.
Well, yes, now you do. But do they actually have a script for it?
They're working on it.
Yeah, I know. That's always the problem.
I don't know what you mean by 3 years then.
Well, each one of those Star Wars movies. Yes, it's pre-production and post-production. I think that is killing them. Correct. Or not killing them. It's just driving up the cost.
They're mapping it out so long in advance that we've got Marvel movies for years in advance and you still feel like they're rushing it.
Well, they have to make their dates. So, you know, there's...
Well, they don't, though. They move them. Well, I guess the Star Wars, they're moving them less.
Yes, correct.
But they had so much room, they were able to do reshoots, you know, it feels like they've got the time to look at it and see it and take care with it. And certainly the Pixar movies, we talked about their budgets, they move their release dates a lot and rip things up and start over. They're not rushing it in the sense of they want to make sure the movie's good.
No, that's true. That is true.
So how are we going to ever find this out? We're not, unless some rogue agent comes to us with secret information.
I think that we should Mother Jones it. And we should go in and work for the studios undercover and then come out a month later and spill the beans.
All right.
And by the way, for those that don't know, that's a reference to a magazine in the U.S. in which they often send people undercover into situations. They then come out and report on those situations, the latest being a private prison.
I did not know that there was their modus operandi.
Well, yeah, it's not their modus operandi. It just so happens that they've done it, more than once or twice or three times.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you got big studios, big egos. It's never easy dealing with Hollywood and all the fights going on. And there was a kerfuffle, a little snippy back and forth between AMC and Fox and NATO. Isn't that true? And we're not talking about the military group, are we?
No, we're talking about the National Association of Theater Owners. And, you know, I happen to know John Fithian. I like John Fithian. I think he's a very smart guy. He's been doing a decent job for NATO for, I don't know, as long as I've known him. So at least 10, 12 years. And I guess James Murdoch said something about the fact that he doesn't like these windows being imposed by cinema owners and that they could be crazy was the word he used in terms of when a movie gets released into home videos and follow-on markets. And I guess John Fithian said, and this is a quote,
In a statement,
he said, Fox and its distribution team have long been and continue to be trusted and valued partners for exhibitors. Mr. Murdoch should be careful he doesn't undermine that trust. He went on to say, welcome to the movie industry, Mr. Murdoch. We hope you'll take some time to learn how it works.
And AMC President Adam Oren said that was, you know, condescending and gratuitous. It's unnecessary. And you know, I have to side with him on this one. There's just nothing to be gained by mocking one of the multinational corporations that own one of your major theater chains and movie studios. You know, there's no point.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. AMC, they don't own AMC.
Right.
Right. So it's just AMC spoke out in defense of James Murdoch and I'm sure NATO regrets it.
Well, I'm sure. And, you know, knowing Mr. Fithian the way I do, I can hear in his response a frustration that time and again, he is constantly having to go back to the studios and say, you do know how this business works. You keep saying these things and you're leaving money on the table every time you do that. And I keep having to come back. Now, James Murdoch, who let's not forget, okay, where was he just 2 to 3 years ago? He was running a newspaper, a publishing
part of a massive multinational corporation, learning the tricks of the trade from his dad.
Yeah, I believe we call that phone tapping, right? Didn't he get run out of the UK on a phone tapping, scandal?
He did not get run out of the UK. Let's not speak legal terminology here.
Okay,
he's been part of this massive multinational corporation his entire life. Let's not pretend he's some new kid. But you don't need to be a new kid in order to say this. Lots of studio heads say this all the time. So that may be part of the frustration. It's not that he's new. It's that studios still go, why can't we release it? You know, they always fight and argue over windows every day. So it should not be that much of a shock that somebody would say that. That's what they say constantly. So, you know.
Now, Adam Aaron, who is the CEO of AMC Theaters, is also new to this business. And by new, I mean, I think earlier this year is when he was appointed. And AMC is a big member of NATO, as is Regal, as is Cinemark. And these are probably, those three exhibitors probably make up a lion's share of NATO's budget. So for AMC to then come out and kind of counter what NATO is saying, that's what makes this kind of an important newsworthy event.
Well, it's not important. It'll be forgotten next week.
Oh,
it
yes,
was unfortunate,
correct.
And he shouldn't have said it, but there you go.
Well, yes, I guess that's kind of what Adam Aaron was saying, that if he had just stopped at, hey, we're important partners together, we should work together, and not added the little kind of dig at Mr. Murdoch directly. You know, I do find it interesting, though, that Adam Aaron said, you know, that he's been working with that AMC has been working with profound respect and appreciation for all that James Murdoch has done. Wait a second, James.
He's the head of a massive multinational corporation. Why wouldn't they say that? Of course you should say that. You're acting like he's some new kid with wet behind the ears. He's a powerful man.
But he said he's been doing it for decades. He's like 42 years old.
And his entire adult life, he's been working in the business, learning it, and learning the trade, so he and his brother could take it over from his dad.
All right, yeah. Well, I kind of look at his entrance into the film part of that business to be fairly recent.
He didn't say anything that every other studio head doesn't think. They're wrong to think it. I'm with 15 on that you should be damn careful before you mess with the formula that has worked for 100 years, and you just had a record box office, and you have record take from all these other areas expanding beyond box office. So yeah, he's absolutely right. You should tinker with this formula with great, great caution. And I agree with that, but James Murdoch is not saying something nutty that every other studio head doesn't say as well.
Right. And I wonder if James Murdoch, kind of being semi-new, you know, if you kind of looks at the numbers and looks at the books and goes, I can't believe we're waiting around for these movie. Like, in other words, all of those other executives at other studios have kind of played that hand and gone through that thinking, you know,
years
ago.
No, they still think it. All right. Right. I'm sighing like Al Gore. Can we move on?
Yes, we can move on. What are we going to move on to? Oh, you know what we could move on to is another industry in peril. How about music?
Are they in peril?
Well, not anymore. Just ask, Bloomberg actually came up with this. They reported on the report from the Recording Industry Association of America that said everything's fine now. No need to worry.
That's not what it said.
Okay, fine. They said that basically there will be 2 years in a row where the recording industry, the music recording industry, doesn't shrink. It's actually going to grow. And in this case, we're talking about retail spending on recorded music growing 8.1% to $3.4 billion in the first half of 2016.
So okay, you don't get crazy with the numbers. You're going to start throwing a million numbers at people.
No. I'm just going to tell you that basically we have the second half of 2016 to really mess it up.
Right. The music industry is growing again. It's the first time in almost 20 years. The last time it grew 2 years in a row was back in the late 90s when you were at the peak of the CD era. So music sales are growing again, but where are they growing? Is it CD sales? Is it LP? Is it digital downloads? Where's it happening?
Vinyl. No, just kidding. It's streaming.
No, it's true. Vinyl's still expanding. That's right. It's far from what it used to be. But yeah, no, vinyl sales are a nice little profit area. But where's the real money coming in?
Streaming music.
That's right. So people have transitioned from buying individual CDs or digital downloads or singles to now buying monthly subscriptions, right?
That's right.
Isn't that better for everybody, right? It's great.
I don't know. I mean, do you like it better than owning the music?
I don't do it.
Okay, there you go. That answers that question.
But I'm saying for the music industry, it is possible. Now, we will have pointed out many times that the total gross of the music industry is nowhere near what it was in the peak 90s. It's way down below. So even though we're growing again, we're not back to where we were. So streaming music sales have not made up that difference. But most people did not buy a lot of albums a year. They didn't spend $120 a year on music. I did. You did. But most people didn't. They maybe three or four or five would be a pretty active music buyer. So nowadays, people are paying $10 a month to access a music library. And ultimately, that's a lot more money than they were spending in the old days. So if enough people sign up for that, there will be that much more money generated. It's possible. And hey, Apple just launched and got 18 million people right out of the bat, didn't they?
Right. Well, and what I would say is, okay, fine. Look, you get $120 per year for one of these. And I am a subscriber to Spotify. And maybe you weren't buying, you know, more.
You weren't buying 10 albums or 8 albums a year. Most people weren't.
Right. And I get it. Spotify keeps 20%, 20 to 25%, but that's still a lot of money. Okay. That's still like, $90 a year going directly to the record companies. And if you could get up to, 100 million people subscribed to Spotify, if you did the math, which I can't do in my head right now, that would be a lot of money.
Is that 100 million worldwide or in North America?
That is worldwide.
You're not going to get one out of three people to.
That is worldwide. Yeah.
Well, that seems very doable, right? 7-8 billion people. You got to be able to get 100 million people to do it, right?
That's right. Yes.
Right. But There's the money. It's being generated. It's growing. But who's getting it? We've already learned that, yeah, money's being made again, but there's lots of tricky deals going on. Record labels are taking a piece of Spotify, a piece of Pandora, a piece of these companies rather than cash on the barrel. And that means they have to turn over less cash to the artists and the songwriters, right? The money is not trickling back down. Videos are being played on YouTube. Who's getting the revenue from the ads that appear alongside them? Songwriters feel like they're getting screwed, and that's why they're suing the Justice Department.
Yeah, and so tell me a little bit more about this. I read this so long ago that I kind of forget what happened. I'm not just shining you on here for you to kind of tell us about the story.
As we've been saying, they're upset about the royalty rates. Yes, Pandora and Spotify are making money, but they're doing it by paying so little for the rights to the music they use. They're saying, hey, we've got a great business here, as long as we get to have access to your hundreds of millions of albums for pennies on the dollar. And songwriters are saying, we need higher royalty rates. They have to pay higher royalty rates because we're not making any money. And if you want to have music to play, you got to be able to feed the artists. And so they're suing the Justice Department to try and get them to work on the licensing rules. It's just one of the many areas where, you know, artists are fighting back to try and get a bigger piece of the money that's still being made.
Well, and look, music has got to be somewhat appealing or somewhat of a loss leader. Depends on how you look at it. Because
Loss leader? Why does it have to be a loss leader?
Well, by that, and this is what I'm referring to, you look at iHeartMedia, which is a big U.S. radio company, right? It used to be, what was it, Clear Channel and Live Nation and all that, and now it's iHeartMedia. They own all these radio stations, right? And now they're getting into streaming music. Same thing, Facebook, you know, it appears to be based on a job posting.
You're saying iHeart is launching a streaming service, much like Pandora and Spotify? It will be on demand, or what is it?
Well, I think they're doing two things. One is going to be more of like a personalized radio just for you, you know, where they know what you like. So you'll pay $5 a month and you won't be able to pick the music, but they'll kind of throw music your way that they know you'll like.
So in my case, I'll be listening to Delilah.
Okay.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Delilah.
And unless you pay the $9.99 per month, which, again, these are not set rates yet. These are, you know, industry expectations. You know, if you pay $9.99, then you can do the on demand where you can say, no, I don't want Delilah. I want, Stevie Nicks or
want Delilah.
Okay. So then maybe you do want Delilah and you want to play it again and again and again, and then you have to pay $9.99 a month.
And she should come on the show. So, they're just basically the same idea as the other services. Basically the radio station's a little different. But the other one is just, they're going to have access to all the music all the other ones have.
Well,
they
have to go and negotiate, their licensing deals with all of these labels, much like Spotify did, much like Apple Music did, much like Rhapsody and Napster.
I assume they have, right?
No. Well, I think they're in the process of doing that. Certainly, they have those deals in place for radio. Facebook is hiring somebody, according to a job posting on, its website, that will go out and do just that, that will kind of form the strategy for whatever music play Facebook wants to make, and then negotiate with the music labels and ensure all the, you know, PROs, the performing rights organizations, get their cut. And so this is kind of a tell, if you will, that Facebook is maybe thinking about getting into the music business itself.
I don't know. What would you do if you were Facebook? What are they going to do?
I have
What's
no
the idea?
Idea. I don't know. I mean, I guess they want to keep people on their website. They don't want people going off to Spotify or some other, which they have a deal with Spotify. So I don't know why they're kind of.
It seems more curation.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe they're thinking, you know what? People are going to start posting music on Facebook. We don't want to have to worry about, all of these takedown notices and licensing issues. So, you know what? We'll just go and cut deals with everybody. And then when they post, you know, we'll give them money for it.
Well, I don't think it's just to allow people. I mean, people can post now links to YouTube videos. So
yeah,
that's not
true.
An issue. I think they're trying to have some play to be like the source of where you're going to learn about, you know, people say, oh, listen to this music. They want to be the place where you do that rather than an email. They want you to do it on Facebook and they don't want you to have to go to YouTube to do it. I think they want to be, you know, have it all right in house.
What I'm going to start? I'm going to start a company called YouBook.
No, Book Filter.
That's true. Well, before we move on, actually, to your pick over at Book Filter, let me ask you this. Did you find some of these numbers? And I know you hate numbers, Michael. I know you hate them.
I just don't want you to confuse people with the third quarter or second, you know.
But let me ask you, I mean, I was fascinated by some of the numbers the RIAA released, specifically in Asia, where South Korea kind of went up and China went up, and there was some big piracy problems in those countries, and now they're kind of bouncing back.
Uh-huh. And what numbers were you interested in?
Well, I kind of liked how China, well, you know, $212 million is what they contributed to the music industry in 2004. Along comes piracy, and in 2010, we're talking $23 million. So 10%.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shrinkage of 90%.
And when it already should have been much, much bigger.
Right. Now,
in 2004, it should not have been $200 million.
Right. Well, now, in 2014, which was the most recent year we have numbers for, I guess that number in China went past $100 million.
Well, it's part of entering, you know, the major international economic, you know, forums and groups. You've got to start obeying international law and cracking down on piracy and cheating in your home country and, you know, play by the rules a little bit more. So I think it's part of that. You know, they can't let that sort of Wild West stuff continue.
Well, when you own the record label, it kind of pays to, you know, maybe make sure that your product isn't being pirated.
Yes, exactly.
But now you were talking about, you were moving us along into Book Filter, and Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, Michael, as you know, and that's a plug for Michael's website. And that Book Filter is where you can go to learn about new releases each week and each month, and you can, you know, find out which releases to pay attention to. So what is the big book of the week? The one book you chose out of thousands coming out this week as the number one pick on your site. In a way, you'd think we moved on to publishing, but we have. And we haven't.
And that's right. We're still in music because it's a memoir. It's Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, the most obviously titled book of the year.
Yeah,
if you're
going
to write a memoir and you're Bruce Springsteen, it's going to be called Born to Run. It's not going to be called Thunder Road. And it's not going to be called Born in the USA, even for various reasons, but Born to Run, his greatest single. You know, it's a memoir by Springsteen. Great reviews all around. It's an obvious pick as the big book of the week. I've been out of the city. I really should have interviewed him and pulled all the stops to try to make that happen. He's been doing just a handful of really select big interviews. I'd love to talk to him because for years you could follow what his music would be based on what books he was reading. When he was reading Grapes of Wrath and stuff, that informed Nebraska. When he was reading this book and that book, you could see where he was heading musically, but based on what books and artists were, you know, holding his attention. So it'd be great to hear, like, did he read other memoirs to see how they were done? What was his writing process? Most people are just talking to him about the music and his dad and stuff like that. I'd love to know exactly how he did it. But it's not the only book out this week. There's tons of them. I haven't read Born to Run yet. I've been sent a copy. I'm looking forward to it. But if you like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, there's the end of a trilogy called The Tale of Shikinoto, which is very fun. You'll find the link on our homepage at bookfilter.com. It's a really fun trilogy of books set in a medieval fantastical Japan, and it's really good. And also, we have a good review for a book called Eleanor and Hick. It's a biography of the romance between First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and journalist Lorena Hickok, and it's highly recommended by our Book Filter reviewer, Janet Rotter. So if you have any interest in those, go to Book Filter and check them out.
Well, you know, you mentioned that sometimes Springsteen would write music based on the books he was reading.
Well, just inspired, yeah.
Right. And actually, I remember seeing him in 2005. He was on a tour just himself. It was just him supporting Devils and Dust. This was
Or not the Ghost of Tom Joad? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this was the Ghost of Tom Joad, of course, was, and Nebraska, really, are the three acoustic albums that Springsteen did solo. Now, Nebraska, of course, he was just doing as a demo, and people said, hey, you could just release this. So we did. But Devils and Dust, I remember seeing him at the Pantages Theater here in Los Angeles, and he was in between songs kind of talking about the inspiration for one song, and I can't remember exactly what it was. But he said, you know, you should read a book called Dying to Cross. You know, that's a song about people in a truck trying to get across the Mexico border. Anyway, this song's about that. And, you know, sure enough, I agree with you. I think he does read quite a lot. I'm always surprised when he's mentioning books. Like, I'm like, you read? Like, don't you have to just, like, shouldn't you be? Isn't it sex, drugs, and rock and roll? I don't think you're taking the sex and drugs part of this thing seriously.
Well, he never went to college, and I think he always felt that lack. And so he's always been sort of an autodidact. He always felt, I think, a little insecure about his education and his knowledge. And so he always worked hard to keep educating himself and keep reading. So he took that very seriously very early on. And we've been talking about artists and musicians and songwriters fighting to get money because of all the digital transformation. More stuff is available to more people more easily than ever before, but the people who create it are not always getting the money. And that's what Philip Pullman is talking about. He's a best-selling fantasy writer. He's also the head of the Society of Authors in the UK, and he's supporting a new proposal from the European Commission, and he wants the UK to adopt it as well because, of course, now the UK is leaving the EU. So everything that happens in the EU isn't automatic for the UK. And these are measures intended to protect authors from being shut out of, you know, a windfall from their books. And there's two clauses that they're pushing. And one is the bestseller clause, which says, you know what? You sign a contract when you're nobody. If your book somehow becomes a huge hit, you are entitled to claim additional and appropriate remuneration if the money you make is way low compared to the profits your book generates. Because when you're a new author, you have no leverage. And therefore, sometimes your books become huge hits and you don't get the money from it. And the other thing they're pushing is the transparency clause, which is a little idea that authors get to look at the books. Clear and regular right to access the accounting on stuff like, you know, sales.
Okay, so when you say look at the books, you're not talking, because I think...
look at the accounting books.
Yeah, okay. Well,
they get to look at the books.
Which I think right now they do have in many contracts. There is the auditing clause where, yeah, you can audit us.
It never happens. You know, you have to fight and go to court to get, you know, access to the actual books of a movie studio.
Well,
and
certainly the
publishers are no better.
Yeah, the studios don't mind putting that clause in because they know, okay, you want to do that. It's going to cost you a fortune. It's going to cost you more than you would get from us if you find we're wrong
or
something.
That is not access to the books.
Right.
Right. So, yeah. Bestseller clause, transparency clause, interesting ideas. We'll have to see how they work.
Well, I think that particular whole, this legislation that you're talking about that the European Commission is pushing for is causing quite a stir.
Right. It could be a big deal if it's enforceable and if it actually gives more teeth for the authors, if it gives them more power to stay a part of the profits that they make.
Yeah, especially because it, you know, TV shows and movies. But you said two key words in that statement there. I think the words deal and big, not necessarily in that order, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is kind of a follow-up. Not since American Idol and The X Factor faced off against one another has reality TV seen a showdown like the one about to take place in the United Kingdom, which, as you now know, is not part of the European Union. We first reported that Channel 4 stole away the smash hit show The Great British Bake Off from the BBC. Turns out they got the format, but only secured one of the four judges to make the leap. The other three, including Mary Berry, the heart of the show, pledged their loyalty to the BBC. And that network could conceivably keep Channel 4's show off the air until 2018. That gives the BBC time to find a slightly new format and launch it with three of the four judges on board. Talk about contract clauses. And before anybody writes, I know the UK is part of the EU. Big deal or big whoop?
It is a big deal. Obviously, like they got the show, but they didn't get Simon Cowell. That's the quickie, pithy way to put it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's a big problem. I mean, they want the format that helps. That's great. But dear God, why would you make that big deal and plunk down all that money if you weren't going to have access to the four judges and they weren't all going to be on board? So maybe they just figured they would come along anyway. But it's a problem. And they may have, be left standing with a bad, bad deal. Idol was very weird. I could never figure out why Pop Idol didn't continue in the UK. They did two seasons, and then Simon Cowell jumped and did The X Factor for a competing network. They never did another season in the UK. Now, it was played all over the world, American Idol, Canadian Idol. I don't think Canada did one, but Australian Idol. You know, all over the world that format was used, but they didn't bother to do another Pop Idol in the UK. And I don't know why. I guess they felt, well, we don't have Simon Cowell. What's the point? In this case, they held on to Mary Berry, so there is a point.
Yeah, I guess so. And it'll be interesting to see whether Channel 4 ever launches it. I guess they will.
They will. They got one of the judges and they've got the format. But, you know, it's the same problem the BBC had with Top Gear. You know, in this case, they've got the show Top Gear, and now Matt LeBlanc has officially signed on for two more seasons to be the host. But ratings are down, and now guess what? Jeremy Clarkson's The Grand Tour debuts November 18th. So that'll be a different format, but it's the host and the guys that people are as attached to as they are to the format. So what's more powerful, the format or the host? We're about to find out in that case.
Well, I think the BBC said, boy, that was a mistake. We shouldn't have let him go. I think they've come out and said that.
Did they? I didn't see that.
Yeah. Now, mind you, again, that was a headline that I saw in passing, and it was.
It may have been the Daily Mail.
Yeah. Ooh, and yeah. Well, don't get me started. The Internet Movie Database, Michael, you know this thing. It's a resource that virtually everyone in entertainment uses at one point or another. It includes seemingly every movie ever made, every American TV show, every episode, every actor and crew member on all of those projects. And when available, it includes people's ages. And that drives actors nuts. The actors say that drives age discrimination, which keeps them from getting work they would be suited for. Lawsuits have flown back and forth, but now California has entered the fray. It just passed a law requiring IMDb to remove an actor's birthday upon request. But here's my question. Will they remove Ben Affleck's work on Jiggly or George Clooney's credit as the lead in Batman and Robin if they ask really, really, really nicely? Now, that would be something actors would love. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop.
Oh, okay.
Because I cannot imagine, and of course, I'm no expert as I strive to prove every week on this show, but I'm no expert, but I can't imagine this holding up in a court. How can you possibly pass a law that says you cannot publish publicly available information about a public figure? That just doesn't make any sense. I don't see how it could fly. You can't publish their social security number, you know, things like that, but their age? And they say, well, it's not really about the big actors. It's really about the middle and the smaller actors that you're not as familiar with. So what are they going to say? Well, you can publish Tom Cruise's age, but not, you know, Wilford Brimley. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Can you imagine this actually holding up? It just seems
ridiculous.
I would
like to see the law itself. I agree with you. I'd like to see the law to see whether it basically says, yes, you can ask and request. However, if the information is available on other sources, then...
Well, that is available. That's the only reason it's there.
No,
of course it's publicly available. It's not. That's why it's there. That's the whole point. It's publicly available information that they have accessed.
That's true.
Yeah, no, and they're saying actors can say, no, you cannot publish public accurate information about public figures. I don't see it happening.
Well, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, that's for sure.
It'll get overturned.
Amazon, which owns IMDb, by the way, is opening up more brick and mortar stores. Sure, they opened up a new bookstore in San Diego, and soon news like that is going to be old hat. But what's really interesting are the dozens of pop-up stores they've opened around the country. Amazon plans to have more than 100 pop-up stores in malls and elsewhere by the end of the year, just in time to showcase stuff like the Fire and Kindle and Echo devices, so people can buy those toys, take them home, and then order everything else they need by simply asking Alexa. And by the way, hundreds of Alexas just went off because we said that. Big deal or big whoop?
Alexa, play Stairway to Heaven.
Why that song?
What?
Why that song?
Just to drive people nuts.
Oh.
So it's a big, I don't know.
That is not one of the choices, my friend.
It is not one of the choices. I think it's a big whoop. They're just pop-up stores. It's a way to get these are devices you want to hold, you want to look at, you want to touch, you want to play with. So it makes sense. I feel like pop-up stores are like the temp workers of businesses, you know, like you don't want to have any employees. Now they don't even want to have damn stores. They just want to pop them up every once in a while and then get rid of them again. So it's kind of depressing, but I see the play. It makes sense. And when people see Alexa, they like it.
Yeah. And it works. Mm-hmm. You know, I have one.
It's a good toy and it will get better.
Yes. I agree. And it really does work. So, well, let's move on to the United Kingdom, which, as we all know, is a part of the European Union, at least for now. We'll see what happens. The UK submission for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. Okay. And it's not foreign film. It's foreign language film. Okay. Well, this year, that film isn't in Welsh or Gaelic. It's an Iranian horror flick in Farsi called Under the Shadows. This well-reviewed flick is about a mother and daughter living in a haunted apartment during the final days of the Iran-Iraq war. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess. It's just a question of financing, right?
Yes,
correct.
I mean,
else it just makes no sense in a way. But hey, you know, I guess, you know, if they've got it and it's the best movie, why not? Is it cheating? Do you feel like it's cheating?
No, I mean, not really. No.
If they fund a movie in, you know, Italian, well, why not?
Right. I mean, if you know, the Weinstein brothers, the Weinstein company, you know, finances an Italian movie, and it's meant for Italy and the U.S. and
But it's not an American submission for best foreign language film. That's the point here.
Right. In this case, it's a British submission for best foreign language
film. Right, but it's not a British film. It's an Iranian film. That's the weird thing here. If the Weinsteins backed Mediterraneo and Italy wants to put it up, that makes sense. This is the weird thing because it's not a British film or Gaelic or Irish or Irish or Welsh.
Well, I don't see it making it all the way to the shortlist, do you?
Well, it's a horror flick, so no.
Okay. Jared Leto has lost his suit and tie. Oh, I'm sorry. No, lost his suit against TMZ for airing a video of himself mocking Taylor Swift. Leto argued that he had hired a freelance videographer to work on a project for him, and the guy had no right to sell the video to TMZ, and TMZ had no right to air it. Leto said he had the copyright to the material and produced a written agreement between him and the videographer, one they signed after the fact, in which the work for hire was detailed. However, the judge said a written contract could come after an oral agreement, but it had to come before the work was actually done to be in force. TMZ prevailed, and given the state-level statutes at play, an appeal seems unlikely. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I guess it just tells you before you let a guy come into your home with a video camera and start shooting everything, make sure you get something on paper.
You know, I wonder if, and I would agree with you, big whoop, but I do wonder if that, you know, this whole concept of you have to have an oral or written agreement in place before the work gets done.
A written agreement.
Yeah, a written agreement in place before the work is actually done. Whether this ruling will have any effect on the fact that many actors, many creative talents, they will go and work on a film and sign the contract later.
Oh, and that happens constantly. We had that whole battle over costume credits, right?
Yes.
In a movie that we talked about from a really good article. I think it was IndieWire, right?
Right.
Yeah, so and you're expected to do that. You know, that's just like, oh, come on, let's get to work. You know, we'll figure that out later. That's, you know, you're a troublemaker if you insist on a contract in advance.
Well, and a lot of the big deal points are worked out ahead of time, and it's going through the lawyers, and, you know, they're kind of crossing their T's and dotting their I's. And by the, I mean, I've actually had, you know, filmmakers show up in a tuxedo or in a suit and tie to sign their contract on the way to the premiere of the movie for the contract they're signing. So, you know.
Seriously?
Yes.
That reminds me of Van Dyke Parks, a legendary musician and arranger and producer, a really great eccentric talent. And I know that when Rufus Wainwright was making his debut album, he got Van Dyke Parks to come in and produce it, and he did his strings on it. And one of the funny things he mentioned was he learned from Van Dyke Parks. That man did not walk into the studio. Not only was there not a sign, he got paid before he walked in. He's like, I want the cash. I want the money. Then I will come work on it. That was how he did. He did too much monkey business in the music industry. He said, give me the money and then I'll show up. You want me to work? You pay me first. Then I'll work. He's like, that's sometimes what you got to do in this world, you know? So he had clearly learned his lesson over many, many years.
Well, I would agree with you. However, there is a company out there that doesn't, okay? And let me ask you something. You want to work for YouTube?
I do, sure.
Yeah, you're in luck. Because YouTube would love for you to work for them.
Awesome.
Yeah, they don't want to pay you, unlike Van Dyke Park, but they will call you a YouTube hero.
That's good.
Yeah, here's the plan. YouTube needs people to flag inappropriate content, field questions in the YouTube help forum, and continue, you know, contribute video captions and subtitling. That sort of work used to be called, the word I'm looking for is, it's a job, actually. But now it's called fun. You get to earn points for volunteering, and that ultimately may give you the chance to get sneak peeks of new YouTube products and even test those products before they are released to the public. By the way, that too used to be a job, but now it's a perk. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Pop-up stores, free employees, everybody's happy except the world.
And people wonder why they're making the same amount of money as they did in 1999.
Exactly. 1999, 1970. middle class and working poor have not seen their, you know, income grow in 40 years.
Well, I guess then...
I wonder where I stand on the debate.
Oh, nearly 30 years after being unceremoniously dumped from the Today Show, Jane Pauley is back anchoring a morning TV show. This time she's doing it at CBS, where the network announced Pauly would succeed Charles Osgood. He anchored CBS Sunday Morning for 22 years before announcing his retirement from the show, where Pauly has been a contributor for 2 years. Before him, Charles Kuralt anchored it for 15 years. No word yet on whether Pauly will have to change her name to Charles, but she can expect to hold the post for as long as she wants, apparently. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, this has to be one of the few gigs on television where you can be 65 and be considered a kid.
Yeah.
You know, taking over for Charles Osgood and Charles Kuralt. And that's awesome. Jane Pauly is a great talent. It's good to see her back in the game again. Not that she ever went away entirely. And this is a big deal because it generates a lot of money. It's 6 million viewers. It leads into the number one rated political show, which is Face the Nation. And yes, it is the rated number one show, even though another show does better in demos. I don't know why any network doesn't emphasize total viewers every minute of every day. Why downplay the number of people watching your show? Why they always focus on demos is beyond me. They should be pushing that so they can get advertisers to pay for every eyeball, not just the 25 to 54 or 18 to 39. But anyway, Jane Pauly, back on the air, working mornings. I just feel sorry for Gary Trudeau.
Oh, why is that? Of course, they're married.
He's her husband. And for 20 years, you know, she worked on the Today Show. And then he had her back. He didn't have to get up at 4 in the morning. And now she's back to that routine again. I hope he's a morning person.
One day a week.
That's true. That's true.
And, you know, it's funny. You mentioned that, you know, at 65, you know, you're a kid in that business. Bill Whitaker, there was a feature profile of him. He's a journalist that is now one of the anchors of 60 Minutes. And
another show where you're a kid at 65.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I was headed with that, is that, you know, they hired him 2 years ago and they're like, no, you're pretty good at this. Yeah, you should keep the job and keep doing what you're doing. And it's like, okay, most people are retiring at your age and you're just getting started.
People don't retire anymore. We don't have any money.
That's true. You just said that. Lionel Shriver, and I can't wait for you to go through this with me, Michael. Lionel Shriver is the author of the bestseller We Need to Talk About Kevin. She is an American who lives mostly in London, a woman with a man's name, and a puckish, controversy-stirring speaker who spoke out about cultural appropriation. It's a word that I always have trouble pronouncing, appropriation. She spoke out at a literary festival in Australia. Her new book includes a black woman with Alzheimer's who is kept on a leash by her homeless white boyfriend. So you won't be surprised that Shriver said writers must be free to write about anyone in any way they felt necessary for their fiction. She said this while wearing a sombrero. And no, she is not Latino. The fest organizers were aghast, hastily arranged a rebuttal session for those who were offended and took down Shriver's speech from their website. It all was a big kerfuffle. There's a word we like this week. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously, but it's a big deal. And I'm just shocked at, did they not read her new book? I mean, they brought her in with a bland topic to discuss of community or something. But if you know anything about her, you know she likes to stir stuff up. Did they not read her book? Did they not read any press coverage of her before inviting her? And then when she spoke, you know, she didn't. You know, burn people in effigy. She gave a provocative speech, but she wasn't, you know, evil or hateful. It's like, can people not debate and disagree? A woman stormed out. They had to have a different session in order to counter what she said. And they scheduled that for the same time she had a reading session for her book, as if just to say, F you know, we're going to do everything we can. And they took down her speech from their website. I mean, what happened to free speech? You're a literary festival. You know, how easily shocked and offended are you? You disagree with her? Say so. Explain yourself. But, you know, good God.
Apparently, we are quite shocked and offended these days at just about everything. And speaking of appropriation, a word I just said properly the first time, Marc Jacobs, the fashion designer, had at New York's Fashion Week, had a whole bunch of models with like these fake dreadlocks, and everybody was up in arms over it. Oh, my goodness, he's appropriating a hairstyle from the African-American community. I guess we're easily offended.
Yes.
Now, the dark comedy Hand to God is about a young man who is either going insane or watching a hand puppet he created for Christian youth outreach become possessed by the devil. It got rave reviews, but did poorly on Broadway and lost money in the West End. Turns out there's a happy ending. The puppet actually came to life. No. despite its over-the-top language and content, the play has turned out to be a hit around the country. The United States is the country in question here. In fact, it was the most produced new play around the U.S. this season, followed by other critical hits like Constellations by Nick Payne, Pulitzer Prize winner Disgraced, and The Christians by Lucas, I cannot pronounce his name.
Hanath.
Hanath, okay. Now, The Christians, that's a great play, by the way. It's about a pastor struggling with his faith. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, Hand to God was a real roll of the dice. I didn't agree with them bringing it to Broadway. It had a low weekly nut, meaning the expenses of running it every week were not that high. I was surprised they took it to the West End. But whatever they spent, I think it worked if it was a long-term gamble to say, hey, ultimately, this show will be worth more if we take it to Broadway. Even if we don't make money on it, that branding helps you around the country. And it paid off. I never would have picked this play to be the number one produced play around the country because it's pretty envelope pushing. It is not an easy play to put on your subscription list. People are going to get offended, like we talked about before. It intends to offend in this case, or intends to get a rise out of you and be provocative. So I'm excited and glad. I like the play a lot. I love the lead guy in it, but it's a well-written play. And to see that in King Richard III, you know, those plays doing really well, that's great. The others make sense to me. Constellations is a two-hander. Disgraced won the Pulitzer Prize. The Christians is one set. It's got about, you know, it's timely for people of faith. It all works for me. And then you've got perennials like Peter and the Starcatcher, Raisin in the Sun, and so on. So to have this play become the most successful play this year, that's really mind-blowing in a way. And I think you have to credit them for spending the money of a loss leader of putting it on Broadway.
Well, I think if you're an artistic director for one of these regional theater companies, right, and you read Hand to God,
surprised you'd put it on.
Well, think about it. If you're thinking, about the full scope of your season, you immediately go, well, wait, all I need is an actor and a sock? Yeah, book that.
Well, no, that's not. It's not a. There's more than one.
I know. Yeah, oh. I'm joking, but yeah.
Okay.
An actor in a sock was the punchline.
Didn't get it.
Okay. Netflix. You know, we talk about them every now and again. They have a goal. This company wants 50% of its library to be original content that Netflix itself has created. Why, you may ask? Because you don't have to license and pay top dollar for someone else's movies and TV shows when you created them yourself. Of course, you do have to make it good. They're one third to one half of the way there, which could be anywhere from 15% to 30%, by the way, of the content. Being original on Netflix right now. In 2016, they're expected to add another 600 hours of new programming. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big deal, right? It means they'll spend less on other property. They'll be less over a barrel and have to make big deals. So it helps them long term. And it just changes them entirely from a site where you go to access any old TV show you can think of to a site where you go to watch Netflix stuff.
You know what I love about Netflix is every month it's something new and exciting, and I have no idea what's going to be there because the movie that I put on my list last week isn't there anymore, and yeah, it's the whole revolving thing is kind of a
bummer.
Yeah. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess, I don't know, how will this story affect our listeners? They're going to get a lot less Paramount movies to see, that's for sure, at least for the short term.
There's not a lot on their upcoming schedule, but this is not just Paramount, it's Viacom in general. And is there anything to say other than what a mess?
What a mess. And this just goes to show you what happens when leadership disappears and there is no leadership.
There's a change in, you know, it's Sumner Redstone coming to the end of his life. And, you know, there's vying for power and then new people asserting themselves. So it's a transition period.
So to catch people up, Sumner Redstone used to be the head of Viacom. He's no longer the head of Viacom. Philip Doman was the head of Viacom and wanted to sell half of Paramount to the Chinese, to specifically Wanda was in negotiations for it. And Sherry Redstone, Sumner Redstone's daughter, said, no, we're not selling Paramount. Well, she won. Doman is out. Okay, and Tom Dooley was kind of promoted at least to be an interim CEO.
And he says, I'm out.
And he says, you know what, this is a mess, I'm out. Although I couldn't figure out whether, was he asked to leave because he was also for selling a portion of the company to anybody for cash.
I don't think they wanted him to leave until they had a successor in place.
Yeah, and I think he probably say, yeah, that's fine, I'm out. So they announced that on Wednesday. They also announced, by the way, we're taking a write-down, and the reason they're taking this write-down is due to, and this is a quote, expected performance of an unreleased film. Now, they didn't say which film that is. They're taking a $115 million write-down, which means they're taking a tax credit, okay? The only film that they have that this could be applied to, since they have so few films, is Monster...
Reasonably. Yeah.
Is Monster Trucks, which they've shelved a couple of times. It was supposed to come out at one time. It didn't come out. They pushed it again and again and again. And now it's coming out January 13th. So everybody's assuming it's Monster Trucks.
So what terrible. They've got the head of Viacom stepping down probably early before they have somebody ready to take over. They have this movie that they have to do a big write-off on because they got a turkey on their hands. At least that's what they're saying. Could it get any worse? What else could happen?
Well, then, you know what? The vice chairman of Paramount could say, you know what? I think I see an iceberg ahead. I'm going to jump into the lifeboat right now. I'm out.
So Rob, who's in charge?
Rob Moore is out. I don't know. I guess Brad Gray is in charge. He's the head of the company. I don't know who's in charge there right now. Sherry Redstone? Who? I can't tell you who's in charge over there.
So this is what happens when you're in transition, right? We've had Paramount underperforming for a few years.
Right.
They have not had a good year so far. We're not done with Star Trek Beyond, but that's not even looking like a success story. So they don't have a lot of good news. What can they look forward to?
Well, on the film front, they can, you know, look forward to Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. That's the sequel to the, you know, first Jack Reacher film.
And that movie barely got greenlit, the sequel, didn't it? I
mean, yes.
I remember the first movie clawed its way. It cost about $60 million to make and grossed $220 million worldwide. We don't know what Tom Cruise got, but that was a movie where they were really iffy on going back to the well on that one, but they decided to do it, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They also made Arrival with Amy Adams with about a $50 million budget. It was premiered at Toronto.
And if the news wasn't bad enough, they have two big Brad Pitt movies, right? And now he's in the midst of an ugly divorce with his wife, Angelina Jolie, which wouldn't necessarily affect box office, but he's starring in Allied, a World War II romance with him and Marianne Cotillard, directed by Robert Zemeckis. It's probably a pricey because it's period and it's war.
Two
big stars. So that doesn't help. And it doesn't help muddying the waters. You don't want to have the cloudiness of his personal life potentially affecting his appeal at the box office briefly. It's just bad timing, right? They had that one movie to look forward to, and now even that is a bit of a problem.
Office Christmas Party, I think, might be one of those sleepers. The trailer's great. It stars Jason Bateman, Jennifer Aniston, Olivia Munn, and Courtney B. Vance. It's a comedy, and the trailer is hilarious.
I'm actually a little embarrassed I didn't pitch this movie myself, aren't you?
Yeah.
Office Christmas Party. It seems like a natural. And then they have two Oscar bait movies at the end of the year, Fences with Denzel Washington and Silence by Martin Scorsese, which they just picked to have an Oscar release date of late December. So they don't even have a lot of big bets going. The biggest bet is Allied, that World War II romance. They have a lot of modest bets here through the end of the year. So there's not even a lot that's going to, if they work, they'll probably work on a modest level. So there's not much in this year to hope for. Next year, they've got two or three movies I'd be happy to have. The Triple X sequel with Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
Baywatch with Dwayne Johnson and Zac Efron. I would really love to have that movie if I was a studio. And Transformers, The Last Night. The last two made $1 billion each. This stars Mark Wahlberg again. I'd be happy to have that, even though that's a big budget movie. But even after beyond that, there's sort of a lot of question marks. So, it's a tough schedule ahead for Paramount.
What about World War Z 2?
Well, again, that's a movie like Jack Reacher where you were almost not ready to pull the trigger on a sequel. They sort of dodged a bullet with the first one. That stars Brad Pitt, of course, and they see it as part of a trilogy, and the books are popular. But the first one was sort of like a, whew, we got away with that one. Tom Cruise in Jack Reacher, that's a $96 million budget movie. That's what we hear. So it's substantially more than the first one, but that's still a pretty safe bet. Tom Cruise and an action film worldwide, you can feel pretty confident you're going to make $300 million. You know, so I feel like that's a safe bet. World War Z 2, that's a bigger roll of the dice and a movie that didn't have very good reviews to begin with. So I don't know.
Well, one thing we do know, unfortunately, is that Curtis Hanson, the filmmaker, passed away last week. He died at the age of 71.
That's right. And if you ever want to know, I mean this with respect, never write anybody off. You think actors are not, don't have talent. You think a director doesn't have talent. You think a writer doesn't have talent. You never know what has kept them from doing the right movie or the right role. You don't know what they're capable of necessarily, or it's just the right person at the right time with the right property. And that's certainly true with him. He made a lot of movies I thought were dreadful. And then almost out of nowhere, I mean, he had a hit or two, but they weren't good movies like The River Wild and so on. But suddenly out of nowhere, he made a great movie, L.A. Confidential. And he followed it up with Wonder Boys, another really good movie. So a guy that I thought was not talented, in fact, The Bedroom Window, I thought was a dreadful movie with Steve Guttenberg. It, at the right moment, at the right time, he produced a great movie and reaped Oscar glory. That's a movie where, you know, Oscar really got it wrong. Titanic swept the Oscars that year. Maybe you give it to James Cameron. I mean, I wouldn't have voted for him just for the, you know, making the movie, but I would have felt LA Confidential would have been a much better pick. It's certainly a much better movie than Titanic.
Yeah, I mean, this was a filmmaker who started off as a critic and a writer and worked his way through the Roger Corman factory and, you know, wound up doing some decent films.
8 Mile was a pretty good movie.
Yeah, and, you know, passed away suddenly, I guess, you know, I don't think...
He was 71.
He was 71, yes. And I guess they're saying he was struggling with some type of dementia.
You were not on top of his medical news, and you didn't know he was alien, and now he's dead.
Correct.
Right, so, as with everybody... family and friends. Usually we don't talk about people unless we can think of something that we have personal to say about them. That's my case with child actor Bobby Breen. This is a kid who was sort of a boy soprano. He had a very fancy, really classical music geared voice, and he became a brief sensation in the movies with a couple movies in the late 30s, early 40s, and then his voice broke and he was tossed out on the street. He actually kept singing his whole life. He had a good voice. It even was a good voice as an adult. But he's really just a brief sort of footnote to Hollywood. You don't really know him unless you were alive at the time watching those movies. But I'm focused on watching every movie ever made from 1939. If it was released in 1939, I want to see it. Why?
Because it was one of the greatest years in motion picture history.
That's right. Everyone always says 1939, that's the triumph of the studio system. So I say, well, let me see everything in 1939. Because yes, we've seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Anachka and Stagecoach. But what were the other movies like? So I've always, if the movie comes on and I can see it and it's from 1939, I will watch it. And that's why I saw Way Down South. This is a Southern film, came out in 1939, the same year as Gone with the Wind. So it's about a boy and his slaves, and he loves his slaves, and his slaves love him. The script was co-written by Langston Hughes, a major African-American writer. So sadly, the movie is just a travesty. It's a dreadful movie. And at one point, this kid just loves his slaves, but he doesn't have control over the plantation because he's just a kid. And the overseer is going to sell him off. And he's distraught. He's crying. He's weeping. And he wanders in the middle of a storm into the barn where it turns out all the slaves are huddled together, crying and weeping. And to comfort them, he gets on a bale of hay and starts to sing, "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child." So we've got a link in the YouTube clips. It's pretty god-awful. But, you know, it's a dreadful movie. But, you know, the kid could sing.
And you sat through the whole thing.
I did. I watched the whole movie. And, you know, I've sat through more golf than I ever thought I would have. I think I first got excited by Jack Nicklaus having his comeback at the Masters. That was one of the great golf comebacks. But Arnold Palmer died this week. He's 87 years old. And we mentioned him because he was such a successful golfer. That is why network TV started airing golf tournaments. He really was the reason. Back in an era when you couldn't even see the ball, they'd hit it. And, you know, black and white TV and a white ball, you had no idea what was where. You sort of had to wait for them to say, and there it is in the middle of the fairway. But, you know, he was such a big star that he made golf a TV sensation.
He also made one heck of a drink.
That's right.
Yes, he's known for a half iced tea, half lemonade is called, at least in the United States, an Arnold Palmer. I guess he drank that stuff. And
I don't know how it got named after him. I don't know if he created it or what.
I don't know. I'm sure that if it will come out in the coming days, I'm sure. But that wraps up this edition, this episode of Showbiz Sandbox. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate, review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Those links and links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox. Like us on Facebook, search for Showbiz Sandbox. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website. Every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Bruce.com.
Okay, I guess you have to go all the way back to the book filter pick for the reference there. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try, the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com where all of his work is aggregated. You can always check out bookfilter.com for his latest picks. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.